You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
That's kind of conversation between the soul. That's conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison. And we're very excited to welcome to the podcast one of the top historians of my generation, Jeremy S. Friedman. Jeremy is a Marvin Bower Associate Professor at Harvard Business School and the author of a couple of books. The one we're really talking about today is Shadow Cold War, the Sino-Soviet Competition for the Third World. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you guys for having me.
So last time we left off in the mid-50s, so perhaps maybe just as a means to remind listeners where we are, what was going on in the mid-50s in terms of the global context of the Cold War, and then in terms of the Sino-Soviet competition, and then we'll talk about this famous secret speech that Nikita Khrushchev gave in 56.
So at the risk of giving away the punchline a little bit early, since we're getting to the secret speech, I actually think that the most important drivers of the secret speech were Soviet domestic politics. But before we get there, a little bit about the global context. I mean, the key thing about sort of where we are in the world in 55, 56 is that, you know, on the one hand, you know, European recovery, Japanese recovery are proceeding. We're getting to the point where sort of the Western Europeans are getting back on their feet economically. Also, NATO was founded in 49. The Warsaw Pact, in turn, is founded in 55. So this is sort of when kind of the familiar Cold War divisions that we know in Europe and the later Cold War are beginning to be set on the one hand. On the other hand, so what that means is essentially they also agree to neutralize Austria in 55. The Soviets pull out. So essentially what's happening is Europe is beginning to sort of freeze in place. So the idea of kind of a war of movement in Europe where, you know, maybe France goes communist or Italy goes communist or there's rollback somewhere, right? That is, it's not over yet. It doesn't really end until the Berlin Wall is built in 61, but Europe is beginning to sort of freeze in place. And what's happening on the other hand is that decolonization is beginning to sort of gain momentum. So the Cold War is just at the point where it's starting to shift from the European theater to the global South. So decolonization doesn't really begin in earnest in Africa until 57 with Ghana. But, you know, things are happening. Mau Mau is happening. There are constant negotiations about what to do about, you know, how to restructure French Africa.
Bandung, so, right, is 55 as well.
Bandung is 55, although, again, when Bandung happens, the only actual independent African countries that go are Liberia and Ethiopia. But yes, decolonization has already begun in Asia. So by this point, you know, India is independent, as is Pakistan, Indonesia, Vietnam. So independence has hit Asia. It's just about starting to hit Africa. And so the Cold War is shifting sort of from Europe to the global South. That's kind of, that hinge point really is about 55, 56. And one of the key moments there is the, you know, the war in Suez, which will happen. I mean, sort of at the same time, you have the Hungarian Revolution in Europe and the war in Suez in the Middle East. And what happens there is, you know, because the West does not come to Hungary's aid, it's kind of clear that if you're behind the Iron Curtain, the West is not going to save you. There's no rollback in Eastern Europe. On the other hand, you know, the fact that Eisenhower ends up siding with Nasser against the British, the Israelis, and the French in the Suez War sort of shows that, like, the Americans are beginning to prioritize the developing world, right, over their European allies to a certain degree. I mean, they will waffle back and forth in that during the Cold War, but that's an important signal in 56. That's kind of where we are globally. But as far as the secret speech, and as far as Sino-Soviet relations, they are at their peak. This is the height of cooperation. You have thousands of Soviet experts all over China. Soviet aid is flowing to China at a rate that probably has never happened between any two other countries in the history of the world. And so, you know, what really, I think, inspires the secret speech is actually Soviet domestic politics, specifically the power struggle that is happening inside the Kremlin after Stalin's death. So Stalin dies March of 53, and it's not really clear who his successor is because Stalin never intended to sort of name a successor.
Okay, so this is a hobby horse I have. Tell me if I'm wrong. I think between 53 and 55, there was actually a chance for early detente. Not the end of the Cold War, but I actually think there was a chance for early detente between the death of Stalin and the Geneva Conference in the summer of 55, I believe, but that the Americans had no intention. I was just wondering, from someone who studies the other side, if you think that's a misinterpretation of what could have happened. Was there a missed moment there between 53 and 55? I have an essay on this. So this is kind of a little obsession. So since I have a Soviet specialist, I wanted to ask you.
Well, so there might have been a moment, but on the Soviet side, the key element here is really the one who wanted detente on the Soviet side, ironically enough, was Lavrenty Beria, the head of the NKVD. He was the one who wanted, was proposing like a deal to neutralize Germany, to, you know, so he's the one who wanted detente. And so if Beria had succeeded Stalin, there might have been a detente. But because he was the head of the NKVD, you know, Khrushchev, Malenkov, and the others saw Beria as the primary threat to them. You know, that he could, he had the goods on them and he could liquidate them. He had the guys to come arrest them and execute them and the whole thing. And he could put on a show trial of Khrushchev and Malenkov. So they eliminated him by the end of 53. So I think once Beria is removed, essentially an internal coup, I think the chances of detente are over because he was the one in the Soviet side who could have done it.
So here's a counterfactual. They come to Geneva and they're like, we actually want to change things. We're not just going to talk about open skies. We're going to talk about serious issues here. You don't think there was a chance that the Soviets would have accepted that?
I think that they were too afraid, and the other leaders were too afraid of essentially losing Soviet conquest in World War II at that point, and what that might mean for Soviet security. So they liked their buffer zone. It was Beria who was willing to sort of give up the buffer zone and say, you know, I mean, neutralizing Germany was the whole key there, because the major Soviet fear geopolitically post-World War II was a resurrected Germany, especially a nuclear Germany. So nobody else really was willing to, you know, to contemplate a united neutral Germany, but they wanted to keep Soviet forces in East Germany. Khrushchev did, Malenkov did. So that's what I think. I mean, I think they would have wanted to back down from, you know, the extreme tension of the end of, you know, the Stalin period, but they were not willing to sort of make the hard compromises that I think Beria, you know, at least explicitly, you know, said he would have. But they removed Beria. But I think, so getting back to the secret speech, I think what happens is, you know, once Beria is removed, then, you know, Khrushchev still has to sort of outmaneuver his, you know, his rivals, who include Malenkov, Molotov, Voroshilov, right? A lot of these people who are more senior than him and who are closer to Stalin than he was. And so in part, the secret speech is a move to, you know, kind of tar them with the Stalinist legacy and, you know, explicate himself. So, you know, Khrushchev had as much blood on his hands as anybody else under the Stalin regime. I mean, let's be clear about that. Khrushchev had a hand in decimating, you know, the Ukrainian party apparatus in 37, 38, the Moscow city, you know, apparatus. So Khrushchev had plenty of blood on his hands. But what he succeeds in doing in 56 is saying, look, these guys have blood on their hands. They're the ones who did it. You know, I wasn't responsible. And so this is kind of a way of, you know, putting himself in the position of, first of all, he's the arbiter of Russian history. He gets to say, you know, what went right and what went wrong. And second of all, he sort of tars his rivals with this, you know, the stain of Stalin.
So how are Chinese and Soviet communists dealing with the big tension that we talked about in the first episode, which is one wants effectively to develop socialism and one wants some sort of peaceful coexistence. Is that correct? Or maybe you could rearticulate the major tension and how they're dealing with it in the mid-50s.
So they both want to build socialism. They will have slightly different ideas about how they imagine socialism being built, but the mid-50s is the closest point that they will ever be, because that is when, again, Chinese socialism is being built largely by Soviet experts with Soviet aid. So that is when they are trying large-scale industrialization. It is really after that, after the secret speech, they will begin to diverge. For now, they both want to build socialism. But what's happening is that, you know, the Soviets think that, look, we suffered World War II. We don't want to have, we can't have another conflict on that scale. Nuclear war is unthinkable. We want to focus our efforts on building our domestic economy, you know, move resources out of the military. And so the Soviets, you know, feel like peaceful coexistence is the way they can focus their resources domestically. While, you know, we were talking about the developing world, and the Chinese are much more plugged in there, right? They see themselves as part of Afro-Asia, part of, you know, the post-colonial world, suffered under imperialism. And so for them, the struggle that's happening really is, you know, the struggle against imperialism and colonialism is still very much primary. So, you know, one very concrete example at this time, you know, the Angolan war against the French begins in 1954. And the Soviets aren't willing to support the FLN in Algeria militarily. The Soviets, partly because they still hope the French communists will take power. They don't want to prejudice the French public against the communists in elections. And so they sort of, you know, don't support Algerian independence, at least not, you know, with military aid at this point. The Chinese, on the other hand, are totally all in on the FLN. So they, you know, invite the FLN to China. They train them. They arm them. They recognize them as legitimate government of Algeria. So that's just one example in which, you know, they both want to build socialism, but the Soviets think they can do it by making peace with the West. The Chinese think that, you know, anti-imperialism and, you know, decolonization comes first.
This is also, of course, 54, 55 is when the United States becomes more involved in Vietnam. Is there any discussion about that in this moment, or is it basically that becomes an issue later in the 60s?
Well, so Vietnam, I mean, there's sort of, from the Soviet perspective, the Chinese perspective, there's a bit of a lull in Vietnam between 54 and 59, right? Because the Chinese were, from 1950 to 1954, the Chinese were very heavily involved in helping Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh fight the French. So that, you know, Dien Bien Phu, all of that doesn't really happen without Chinese military aid. And there, you know, there's Chinese military leaders on the ground in Vietnam helping the Vietnamese, you know, fight that war. Then 54, you have the peace agreement, you have the division of Vietnam, North and South. And then it really becomes a story of, you know, how do we help build communist North Vietnam? And so there's a land reform that happens, which the Soviets and Chinese are involved in. They help both with the organization of the land reform, the implementation, you know, economic aid and such. And it isn't until 59 when the North Vietnamese Politburo takes the decision to begin military activity in the South. That's against the wishes, by the way, of both Moscow and Beijing at the time. They take the decision, Hanoi takes the decision on its own, despite opposition from Moscow and Beijing. But that's when, you know, the Vietnam War really gets going again.
Okay, so let's talk. What happens in the wake of the secret speech? How does this inform Soviet-Chinese relations? If you said the height was the mid-50s, I assume there's a slow decline, but maybe you could take us through the latter half of the 1950s. And perhaps up to, it'll be interesting. I'm curious what the next turning point is. Is it Checkpoint Charlie? Is it the Cuban Missile Crisis? What is the next turning point there? But take us through the 50s up to the next turning point.
Yeah. So what happens is, you know, as I said, the secret speech is really done, I think, by Khrushchev largely for domestic political reasons. And the problem is because he's doing it for domestic reasons, he's not thinking about the international consequences. And for the Chinese, you know, Mao is not concerned about Molotov and Voroshilov and whatever, right? That's not his concern. He's concerned about Stalin's international reputation and the fact that really the entire international communist movement is built around Stalin's reputation, right? To many people in the world for, you know, the last 30 years, communism meant Stalin. He was the Soviet Union. And so to undermine Stalin is to undermine the prestige of communism all around the world. And that might also affect him personally, Mao, because it's not a huge stretch for people in the Chinese Communist Party to say, you know, Stalin had a cult of personality that was dangerous. Now Mao is our Stalin. He has a cult of personality that's dangerous. So, you know, to attack Khrushchev or to attack Stalin could mean to attack Mao too. So for the Chinese, and not just for the Chinese, but for others, you know, the Indonesian communists, you know, others around the world, undermining Stalin threatens to undermine themselves and undermine communism full stop. So the Chinese begin to push back on this and they see, you know, there's, in the wake of the secret speech, which is supposed to remain secret, but becomes public very, very quickly for interesting reasons. But, you know, the Poles and the Hungarians see this as an opportunity that maybe we can, you know, rebel against communist rule. And this, you know, this is exactly what Chinese said. Look, you attack Stalin, you undermine communism. Of course, people are rising up in Poland and Hungary against the regime. And so there's this moment in which, you know, the Soviets, believe it or not, the Chinese are actually crucial to this. A lot of documentation, post-Cold War has proven this. The Soviets don't invade Poland in 56, but they do invade Hungary. And the Chinese are crucial to that decision. The Chinese basically tell them, you know, don't invade Poland, invade Hungary. And they almost, you know, they respond to Chinese advice. But this is proof in the Chinese mind that you've undermined the communist system by undermining Stalin.
Are there any theoretical developments on what communism is over the course of the late 1950s and the Cold War period? Because obviously in the United States, and apologies, everyone, I'm truly an Americanist, but in the United States, there's a transformation of what things like democracy mean. There's a transformation of things like labor and what capital are supposed to do and what is a consumer. So I'm just curious if there's any theoretical transformations in communism in this Cold War period, particularly when you're talking about these two enormous states.
So there are profound shifts in what communism means over time, which to be perfectly honest, is actually a large part of my second book, Right for Revolution, which is chiefly about that. But there are, I would say there are, you know, there are different reasons why there are shifts in what communism means. The problem is by, you know, the 1950s, 1960s, you get to a point in the world where communism is no longer facing the conditions that were anticipated by Marx and Lenin. Right. On the one hand, in the West, you have welfare state capitalism. Right. Lenin had always said, you know, and Marx had said that, you know, the problem is the bourgeois would never let the workers, you know, rise above subsistence wages. And therefore, you have this, you know, situation in which the workers would be productive but couldn't buy their own production. But then you have the welfare state. And all of a sudden, workers in the West, right, especially in the United States, the 50s and 60s, have middle class lifestyles and houses and cars and refrigerators. And then, you know, there's no longer seems like a chance of the working class taking power. You know, maybe the 1930s when you had strike waves in the West. And so one problem is that, you know, you have this issue of the welfare state capitalism and, you know, you need a surrogate proletariat. Herbert Marcuse looks at that and, you know, maybe it's women, maybe it's minorities, maybe it's students and so on and so forth. That's a problem all around the West. You will eventually have the problem in, you know, the communist world that central planning, the growth rates are slowing down. Central planning is becoming less efficient. And it's not really clear. So you start thinking about market reforms, which will ultimately result in sort of the big bang of Chinese reforms in 78. But there's beginning to be thinking about market reforms much earlier. So the Yugoslavs are doing this in the 50s. The Hungarians have goulash communism by the late 50s. The Kosygin reforms in 65 in the USSR. So really the thinking about market reforms under communism is well underway by the 1950s. And the third thing is that you have, you know, all these post-colonial states who, many of whom would like to be socialist, but of course, Marx did not envision socialism happening in countries that don't have industry, don't have a working class, right? You know, barely have a functioning political system. So how do you develop a model for that? And then one of the things that happens between the Soviets and the Chinese at precisely this time. So one of the key moments is that in 61, at the 22nd Party Congress, Khrushchev introduces a plan for the Soviet Union to reach communism by 1980. And this is very controversial. The Chinese don't like it for various reasons. And part of the problem is that Khrushchev envisions what it means to become communist in very sort of, you know, consumerist commercial terms. It means that the average Soviet citizen will have a better quality of life, will literally consume more meat per capita than people in the United States, right? Or consume more meat per capita than people in the UK and such. And to Mao, this is, you're playing the capitalist game. Like, we're not going to beat the capitalists at consumerism. The whole point of communism is, you know, the creation of a new man who responds to different kinds of incentives, right, who is not this consumerist beast. And so Mao says, look, if you're trying to beat the West at their own game, levels of consumption, you're going to lose. But that's not what communism is supposed to be. Communism is about, you know, working together for the good of society. And so that's really kind of, between the Soviets and the Chinese, that's the most fundamental, so philosophical stream about what communism means is, does it mean outcompeting the West in a, you know, consumerist materialist sense or not?
That seems like a gigantic difference, because basically the way one could read that is one is essentially saying capitalism won, in effect of the structuring of what humankind's goals should be. So that seems like an enormous shift. Am I misunderstanding something?
No, I mean it's an incredibly fundamental division. And again, it's one that doesn't just concern the Soviets and Chinese. I mean, the Cubans are also very much this, you know, model of a new man. Right, one who is not built around kind of consumption, one who is not built around, you know, the notion of private property. Right, I mean, Khrushchev's model includes private property. He begins allowing garden plots so that, you know, farmers can grow their own private food and sell them on their own private market outside the plant.
Is this a theoretical difference between private and personal property that's developed, or is it something different?
It's not necessarily, you know, completely private property in the legal sense understood by the West, right? It doesn't mean that, like, this land is yours, you can sell it, you can inherit it, that kind of thing. But it does mean that, you know, this is your land, which is not part of, you know, the communal farm that, you know, you can use to grow your own personal goods for either for personal consumption or for sale in the market. So it's to a certain degree similar to what will happen in Chinese rural, you know, reforms, post-79 when they start allowing, you know, they have a household responsibility system. It's not exactly the same thing, but it's the same sort of idea. You don't create private property in land, but you do allow for a private market in agricultural goods, if that makes sense.
That makes total sense. So before we talk about both of these great powers relationship, or I guess a great power to an up-and-coming great power to the developing third world, the global south, whatever you want to call it, why do you think that the Soviet Union developed this perspective? Is it just that they just never had quite the same experience of colonial domination as China? And that's basically it. There's a gear toward Western Europe in a way that there isn't in China. What do you think explains this pretty big divergence in theoretical perspective?
So I think that's a major part of the story. So one of the things I talk about in Shadow Cold War is that, you know, these are two parties that call themselves communist, that both look to, you know, the writings of Marx and Lenin. But the revolutions themselves have two very different ancestries. And they're really responding to sort of different tasks set by their kind of national histories. So the task of Russian history, really as defined by Peter the Great, right? And so therefore, at this point, it's over 200 years, is catching up with the West, right? What Peter the Great wanted to be is he wanted Russia to be, you know, equal or superior to or competitive with, you know, the Western Europeans, the French, the Dutch, the English, the Italians, you know, later on the Germans, and so on and so forth. And so that meant, like, that's kind of what they were aspiring to, right? Therefore, in the minds of someone like Khrushchev, right, and one should remember that, you know, Nikita Khrushchev is not like some great, you know, intellectual. He is not, you know, a Marxist theorist. He did not, you know, really much higher education.
We follow Khrushchev thought on American prestige, but I'll allow you to continue.
But yeah, no, I mean, he's a peasant from rural Ukraine who eventually learned to become an engineer because he basically went to night school, which are called Rabochi Fakulteti, like these workers. Universities that were set up, you know, in the 1920s. You know, he's an engineer who trains after work, coming from the peasantry. So his notion of, you know, what communism is supposed to deliver is the kind of material prosperity that he associates with Western Europe that the Russian people have not had. And that's when you succeed. You succeed when the Russian people don't have to starve anymore. When the Russian people are well-dressed and well-fed and, you know, look like Western Europeans, that was the point of the revolution, really, from, you know, in a core way for Khrushchev. And so, and it's about catching up with Western Europe, which, you know, is the task of Peter the Great for every sort of Russian regime since then, which, you know, in a weird, perverse way, Putin's been doing as well, right, or attempting to do.
I mean, he explicitly says it, I think, at a couple of points, not super often, but doesn't he reference Peter Putin at several points?
Oh, Putin certainly does, but I don't want to get sidetracked talking about Putin too much.
No. Yeah. But it's a theme in Russian history is the only thing that I want to underline. Sorry. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the key, you know, inflection points in Russian history is Peter the Great. I mean, there's no question about that, I think. But on the Chinese side, so China's China, right? I mean, people have said, you know, said to death that, you know, Zhonghua means the central kingdom, China's center of the world. China is not catching up with anybody. That's not what the Chinese task is, right, is that China was once the center of the world, the pinnacle of civilization, and it should be again. And so the question is, you know, now that it's sort of somehow fallen behind and been attacked by these barbarian imperialist powers, how do you restore China to its international prestige, right? That's about overturning the world order in a certain way. And that means, you know, again, dethroning the Europeans and dethroning a lot of the things that come with the Europeans. So their philosophies and their ideologies, right, going back to something else that seems more authentically Chinese and putting that at the center of, you know, global civilization, global culture. And so for that, right, that's much more of a kind of national project, a project built upon rebuilding national prestige and national dignity and national power than it is about, you know, individual materialist consumption.
How does that square with the fact that communism is a very European ideology?
So it's a good question. You know, part of it is that, of course, by the time communism, not when it initially gets to China, but by the time the Chinese Communist Party is formed, it's translated through Russia, which is, you know, quasi-European, for starters. But then, you know, this is part of the reason why, you know, Mao is so willing to, you know, diverge from Stalin, to diverge from the Soviets, is that there's always this idea that, look, you know, what we are doing is adapting communism to Chinese circumstances, Chinese characteristics, sometimes Asian characteristics. And so they're very explicit about that. I mean, you don't, you know, other European powers, you don't get a lot of discussion about, you know, we have to have, you know, communism of, you know, Polish style communism or, you know, Slovak-style communism, right? There's an idea that, you know, communism is supposed to fit the European condition, but Mao is explicit from really from the late 1930s, if not, you know, even a little bit earlier, that, you know, this is going to be a Chinese-style communism that fits our circumstances.
I guess the only one you really get in Europe is Yugoslavia, as a sort of an institutional perspective. You kind of get communism with Yugoslav characteristics. Is that right?
Well, but the thing is, Yugoslavia is really kicked out of the Comintern. I mean, sorry, the Common Form. Yeah, so like that wasn't their choice to leave. In 1945, Tito was Stalin's most loyal disciple.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, no, that's really important. So that was fantastic, Jeremy. Thank you so much. All right, so we're in the late 1950s. And again, I'll bring in my American perspective and then you could sort of complement it, which is that this is, of course, the 50s is the great theoretical development of modernization theory, which is that the United States is basically going to secularize the world. And here's my hot take. You might be interested in this, is that I think almost all of them, I would put the number at 80% of the modernization theorists primarily writing at MIT, but not solely, are Jewish. So what I think is happening is that Jews, second and third generation Jews, essentially want to use the U.S. state to repeat the experience of Jewish secularization at a global scale. And this is kind of the ideological substrata of modernization theory. People are imagining themselves like they came out of the ghettos, literally the ghettos of Eastern Europe, and that was due to, you know, Western culture and all that. And they want to use the U.S. state to kind of do that for the rest of the world and push people forward. So there's a teleology to that, too, that is, I think, explicitly linked to the Jewish experience of modernity. But what's happening in the Soviet Union and China with regards to the developing world, the third world in the late 1950s? How has that developed over time? And how does this relate to the communist theories that we had just been talking about?
Yes, I think what you're saying fits in, right? There are several sort of well-known jokes about this. You know, what language do you speak at an Esperanto conference, right? You speak Yiddish, right? The only true Habsburgs were Jews, right? There's this perpetual association of Jews to any sort of internationalist cosmopolitan project. And this happens in the USSR, by the way, in 1952-53, sort of Stalin's last crusade was to go after rootless cosmopolitans, right? He was, according to some versions of this, Stalin was imminently planning the murder of the entire Jewish population of the USSR when he died.
Right. This is a Zogananta doctor's plot, right?
So the doctor's plot is the beginning of this. I mean, I was told when I first lived in Moscow in 2003, I stayed with this, you know, old Jewish woman who was, you know, at that point in her 80s. And she told me, like, and, you know, this is no documentation. This is just one old woman in Moscow. She told me that, like, all the Jews had been given orders on a certain day in March to report to Kazansky, Vauxhall. They were all going to be put on trains into Siberia, and then who knows what happened. And then Stalin died, and the orders were rescinded, and they didn't have to go to the train station. So maybe that's true, maybe that's not. But like stories like this have been told. I think there's this perpetual notion of Jews as rootless cosmopolitans, which is associated with all sort of internationalist plots, you know, up to George Soros today. But as far as...
I mean, I think there's a genuine internationalism. That's a good thing. You know, it doesn't have to have a... I think that's one thing that the Jewish diaspora gave to the world is this type of cosmopolitan internationalism. I like that, the sort of humanism behind that. Obviously, in today's, you know, climate, that's oftentimes critiqued. But, you know, I don't think we should necessarily run away from the internationalism of sort of these post-imperial Jews. It's a transhumanism. It's a good thing, at least in its... valence.
Right. But, you know, this would get us way too far, of course, at the risk of doing this, right? The great opposition to this is the rise of Zionism at precisely the same time, and the embrace by Herzl and Jabotinsky of the most extreme version of integral nationalism.
The Jewish century argument, right? The Jews are basically on the periphery, so they embrace all of these various ideologies in, like, particularly extreme forms. Yuri Slezsky, great book. All right. Sorry to interrupt.
But so we want to go back to the developing world and the Soviets and Chinese, correct? Yeah, so I go through this in Shadow Cold War in sort of agonizing detail, the ideological debates, because, you know, I think we talked about in episode one how Stalin...
We like detail here. Let's go through it in detail. I like detail.
Okay, so we talked about in episode one, I think, how, you know, Stalin did not really take the possibility of revolution in the post-colonial world very seriously, because he thought, you know, first of all, there's no working class, there's no industry, there's no communist parties. And second of all, who are these people taking power? Like, who is Nehru, really? Nehru is this, you know, Brahmin elite who was educated at Cambridge, right? Who was probably having an affair with the wife of the last, you know, British governor general. Like, this is not a revolutionary. This is not an independence leader. This is a, you know, a handover of power to a trusted elite. And so if that's what he thought about India, that's what he thought about a lot of places. That, like, this is not really independence decolonization, right? This is a, you know, a handover. This is a fig leaf. So that's So he didn't really take the idea that like the Soviets could make revolution in the developing world or that they could become true Soviet allies in the Cold War all that seriously. Right. And this is also a period of time where, you know, Latin America is mostly heavily allied with the United States, voting with the U.S. in the General Assembly. So the idea of like a global South the Soviets could lead under Stalin was never seriously considered. Khrushchev begins to reconsider this as decolonization. You know, India talks about socialism. India talks about planning. He visits India, you know, famously in 54 and 55. And they begin to communicate with the Soviets about planning. So they begin to sort of change their minds. But then the question is, okay, if the developing world really wants to be socialist, right, how is this going to happen? Because, again, there's no industry, there's no factories, there's no working class, there's very little infrastructure. You know, you have all these problems. You have, you know, lack of, you don't have political parties. You don't have a lot of political influence. You don't have, you know, armies. You don't have secret police. You have all these, you know, religious figures who have lots of political power, and you have people who believe in religion. You have people who see oppression in terms of ethnicity and race and religion and gender rather than in terms of class. So it's hard to tell people that, right, you know, nationality is some sort of, you know, bourgeois, you know, obfuscation when people see like, no, it wasn't the bourgeoisie that oppressed us. It was the white people, right? Or it was the Christians, or it was, you know, how you see oppression is very different. So, you know, how, therefore you had to sort of develop a model over time. And you couldn't just say, well, the workers will take power because what workers? So, what this leads to, there's a lot of theoretical debate inside the Soviet Union, you know, in the late 1950s about this. And again, this is, I was a yeshiva boy. I spent a lot of time studying the Talmud. I love ideological debates. I go through this in great detail in Shadow Cold War. I read so many thousands of Soviet journal articles about this. And where it sort of ends up by 1960, when it's sort of codified, there's the Moscow meeting of the International Communist Movement in November 1960, which is the last time that something like the entire international communist movement represented by all the world's communist parties meet in one place and sign the same declaration. From that point on, the Soviets and the Chinese will not do that anymore. But that's the last time the Soviets and Chinese are in the room and sign the same piece of paper, the Moscow Declaration. And that includes—
Could you contextualize why it's the last time? I think it's important just to maybe step out for a second. And you could even talk about a little bit what comes next, because this, I think to some degree you're saying, and I tend to agree, is kind of the end of international communism as like a viable or at least imagined political project. After this, you get very quickly the Cuban Missile Crisis, you get Checkpoint Charlie. And I kind of agree with Stevenson that that's a big shift in the geopolitics of the 20th century. So one, tell me if I'm wrong, and two, contextualize why this is really the last time.
So it's certainly a big shift. I would not argue it's the end of international communism. The analogy I would use is say, it's kind of like the Protestant Reformation, right? So the Protestant Reformation is not the end of Christianity. It's not even the end of the Catholic Church.
Totally.
But yeah. It's the end of the monopoly of the Vatican, right? So that's what I would say, right? It's the Protestant Reformation of communism in a certain sense. But what happens between, so the Singer speech is in 56. Between 56 and 1960, things keep getting worse and worse. There are a number of clashes over various things. You know, the Soviets want to station submarines off the Chinese coast. The Chinese think the Soviets are trying to control them. The Chinese start, you know, shelling Taiwan without Soviet approval. The Soviets think that they're, you know, threatening war with the United States. You know, in 1959, there's a border war between China and India, and the Chinese think the Soviets are supposed to support them as, you know, treaty allies, and the Soviets are not supportive enough. And so these things keep on happening. And by 1960, it reaches the point when, you know, in the summer of 1960, Khrushchev, who's, you know, again, not a great intellectual, not known for planning or thinking things through very well, decides overnight, you know what, I'm removing all the Soviet experts from China. And all of a sudden, those thousands of advisors, thousands of engineers who are building the Chinese economy are just pulled out overnight in essentially a fit of rage. And from that point on, right, that's really kind of the point at which the Sino-Soviet split, you know, can't reverse itself, right? That's the point of no return. Because from that point on, right, the Chinese, they're in the middle of the Great Leap Forward, which, by the way, also happens because Mao is trying to sort of leap ahead of the Soviet Union development. But, you know, the middle of the Great Leap Forward, the economic situation in China is very bad. They have a devastating famine, and the Soviets pull out their aid at precisely this time. This is when the Chinese are on their own.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. Carvana makes car buying easy. Isn't that right, hun? Dax?
Sorry, Did you know about this 7-day money-back guarantee?
A week to evaluate seat comfiness, you say?
A week of terrain tests? Yeah, I can test the brake pad resistance at variable speeds.
Make sure all the kids' stuff fits nicely.
Make sure our stuff fits nicely.
Oh, the...
Right. Still need to buy the car. Getting ahead of ourselves here.
Buy your car with Carvana today.
Your child has so much potential, but your local schools may not be right for them. Check out K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited tuition-free online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.
Why does he make such a drastic move? Why does Khrushchev make such a drastic move? It seems like a pretty big deal to do on a whim. Maybe it just, that's the agency in history, but why?
Yeah, so it's a good question. I mean, it's the same sort of question as to, like, you know, why did Khrushchev suddenly decide to put missiles in Cuba, which he would be, you know, these would be the things that he would be attacked for 2 years later when he would be removed essentially in an internal party coup, was these sort of rash decisions. Basically, he thought that, you know, Mao didn't respect him. Mao didn't accept Soviet leadership. Mao wasn't a loyal member of the communist bloc. And so he had to be brought back into line. And if he wasn't going to be a loyal ally, I mean, this is almost like, it's on a much grander scale. But, you know, as an Americanist, you probably appreciate the sort of, you know, fits of pique that American leaders had at times of the Cold War towards the French, right? When the French pull out of NATO, when de Gaulle, you know, deals with Mao and such. And there's always this anger, you know, these damn French are getting in the way again. You know, we should punish the French. Right. So this is that on a much grander scale, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. So maybe you could tell us what happens in 60 and then what follows from there.
Yeah. So this, the removal of the advisors, this really sort of, you know, again, the point of no return for the Sino-Soviet split. There's really one last attempt to bring unity to the National Communist Movement in November 1960 in the Moscow meeting. The Moscow statement that both the Soviets and Chinese signed was really brokered by Ho Chi Minh himself. It was Ho Chi Minh who made heroic efforts with both delegations to try to bring the Soviets and the Chinese back together because, you know, the North Vietnamese were afraid that if these two divide, we can never, you know, win the war in South Vietnam because we need Soviet and Chinese support. And so Ho Chi Minh is the one who personally brought them back together one last time. And part of this declaration is they achieve a united position on what we're going to do in the developing world. And they create this term of a state of national democracy. These are enshrined in the Moscow Statement, which will follow a non-capitalist path of development. So non-capitalist path of development means it's not socialist yet, it's not communist yet, but you're going to go around capitalism to get to socialism at some point in the future. You won't go through a capital stage, right? Marx had these stages of history, right? You know, primitive communism, slavery, feudalism, capitalism, socialism. We're going to skip the capital stage. And the reason you can skip the capital stage is because there already is an existing, you know, socialist camp, and they will provide the aid and they will provide the technology. So you don't need the development at home. You'll get it from the outside. And of course, there's no working class yet, but there is what's called a national bourgeoisie, right? A local bourgeoisie who are the people who led the independence struggle, as opposed to the comprador bourgeoisie. The comprador bourgeoisie are basically the merchants, right, whose interests are tied to the imperial power. So the idea is that the national bourgeoisie will push out the comprador bourgeoisie. These are your local artisans, local professionals, you know, local business owners, and they're the ones who are interested in independence. And so they'll ally with, you know, some leaders of the peasantry, some of, like, you know, you have rural chiefs and such, you know, some, you know, rural traditional elites, and that, you know, as the economy develops over time, you'll, the working class will grow, and this ruling coalition, which will begin with the domination of the national bourgeoisie, will shift to the left over time, right? As industry develops, as the working class grows, they develop a party, and one day they will develop a communist party that will push out the national bourgeoisie, and once that happens, you will transition to socialism.
So is there a theory of democracy? Is the idea is that they're going to use parliament? Is there a theory of revolution, or is there the idea that it'll be different in each individual case?
So the truth is a little bit of all three. It's complicated and depends on the setting. So there is some advocacy for democracy, but democracy is always temporary and instrumental. The idea is that, you know, the point of democracy is for, you know, the left and the working class to grow in power. But when it reaches a certain point that it can actually hold a monopoly of power, then you don't want to let the reactionaries hold power anymore. So democracy is a transitional stage. This is kind of, this plays out most clearly in Indonesia, for example, where the Indonesian Communist Party, you know, is successful in, to a certain degree in parliamentary elections in the mid-50s, but it sort of reaches a ceiling at about 25%. And so the Indonesian Communist Party and the Soviets begin to support Sukarno as, you know, a kind of a left-wing guided democracy. I talked about this a lot again in Right for Revolution. So there is some support for democracy, but democracy as a transitional stage. Instrumental use of democracy as a way of bringing the left to power. There are certain cases in which, you know, if you already have kind of a left-wing regime in power, let's say someone like Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana or Sekou Touré in Guinea, who's, you know, is a union leader, that maybe, you know, you can sort of build a party that begins as sort of, you know, quasi-leftist, progressive, not, you know, really working class, that will gradually become a working class party over time. And then there are instances, you know, where it looks like you have to have, you know, armed revolution, right? That means like places like Algeria or Angola or the Congo, right, after Lumumba's killed, for example. And the Chinese are really the ones who are most promoting the kind of, you know, independence only really happens when you take power violently. That's the only way you truly break your dependence on the imperialists.
Jeremy, one question. So I studied Weimar Germany, and democracy there didn't lead to socialism or communism. So I was just wondering if in the 60s, late 50s, early 60s, there's any discussion of the actually existing empirical histories of what happened in Western Europe, Central Europe, which was supposed to be the heart of communist revolution.
Well, so again, there's a, you know, a bit of a division between what happens in the West, which are very different in terms of their class structures and their economies and their sociology and what's happening in the developing world. But the fundamental idea is that, you know, if you believe in democracy as a transitional stage, which, by the way, for example, reaches its high point, you know, I have a chapter on Allende in Chile in Right for Revolution, and that's where the Soviets are most supportive of democracy as this path to socialism. If you believe in a transitional stage, what that means is, you know, if allowed to operate in a pure sense, that's where it will go. But the capitalists, right, will never let it get to that point. The capitalists will interfere. Part of this is, you know, there's a false consciousness thesis, right? There's, I mean, you know about this from Gramsci, of course, and, you know, hegemonism, but the Soviets don't necessarily discuss Gramsci that much. But there is still a notion of, you know, false consciousness, the idea that somehow, right, you can prevent the working class from seeing their own interests clearly, right? You can deceive them. And so part of what the Soviets do is, like, they're always assuming that, you know, the West is interfering in democracy, the capitalists are interfering in democracy, so we have to counter that interference in order to sort of neutralize it, to allow history to take its proper course. And so the idea of faith in democracy always does mean that you have to be playing this game to be constantly countering what you see as, you know, the influence of the capitalists or the influence of the West.
Jeremy, can we talk a little bit about the role that the Soviet dispute with Albania plays in the early 60s in terms of, you know, not just kind of furthering the Soviet Sino split, but really, I mean, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but sort of maybe establishing China as an alternate pole of, you know, for Marxist-Leninism around the world. What's going on there? I've always been kind of curious about this. Of course, Hoxhaism doesn't really emerge as a separate thing until the 70s, but there is this decision to break with the Soviets and kind of go with China that I think is interesting.
Yeah, so interesting about Albania. I mean, I think, you know, you've probably heard the story. This is really true, especially, like, you know, around 1960, 61. You know, the Soviet-Soviet dispute doesn't become very explicit on both sides in a public way until 63, when Deng Xiaoping and Suslov have their sort of exchange of polemics. And again, they still formally have an alliance treaty. So since it's bad form to sort of attack your ally publicly, you know, this takes the form of the Chinese attacking the Yugoslavs and the Soviets attacking the Albanians as a way of getting each other, but, you know, not being explicit about it. So there's a certain element of that, right, is that it's understood when one is attacking the other, they're really attacking, you know, these small countries are really attacking, you know, the other power. What happens with Albania is, you know, the question at that point is, who's going to follow Albania, right? Albania by itself is, you know, is not obviously that big a deal. I mean, there's talk at some point the Chinese are going to station nuclear weapons in Albania and point them at the USSR. This happens, like, after, you know, the Chinese nuclear test in 64. And it's, you know, it's a little bit silly. There's discussion of that. But it's not good. There's no way for the Chinese to get a nuclear missile to Albania, right? That's pretty hard to do in their circumstances. But you know, there were, because there was, I mean, there was you know, East German uprising in 53. There were the Poles and Hungarians in 56. There, of course, was pushing, you know, Tito out of the Common Forum. And so things were not great in the Eastern Bloc, right? There was always a fear that, look, you know, maybe other countries decide to follow Albania. And one of the countries they were most worried about was Romania. You know, once Ceausescu comes to power, Ceausescu and the Soviets do not have great relationship. Ceausescu becomes a thorn in their side, especially, you know, by the 70s. He's, you know, really kind of, you know, a privateer when it comes to foreign policy. And so there's a period of time, especially in the early 60s, when it looks like maybe Romania will follow Albania into the Chinese camp. And if Romania does, then maybe you start getting, you know, this kind of, you know, domino effect, right? You know, maybe then Bulgaria follows, maybe Hungary follows, maybe, you know, and then who knows what, right? A lot of people are dissatisfied with Moscow. But once, when Romania does not defect, which is pretty clear, I mean, this is why the Soviets never, you know, go in and remove Ceausescu the way, you know, they removed Nagy or, you know, Dubček or someone else, because, you know, Romania's trouble, but Romania's not going to, it's not going to leave the Warsaw Pact. It's not going to become capitalist. It's not, Romania is not, it's not going to defect in that way. They don't, you know, once they realize that's going to happen, and this really happens in the early 1960s, they realize it's contained to Albania. And if it's contained to Albania, the rest of the Eastern Bloc is not in danger. That's not really, you know, Albania becomes less of an issue for Moscow.
So American prestige's theory that we could have had a fourth way Albanian communism doesn't hold up to empirical scrutiny?
Well, so I'll tell you a story. I was once giving a paper at University of Texas, Austin about Allende's Chile. And it was a lot about, you know, division in the regime between the socialists, the communists and such. And somebody raised his hand and says, well, you know, I mean, of course the regime was very divided, but it didn't really matter, right? Because the CIA was always, you know, going to overthrow Allende no matter what happened. And I said, and this other guy, professor from Ecuador, raised his hand and says, you know, this mattered a lot. He says, I was, you know, on the, you know, Ecuadorian left. And, you know, I was in university in the late 1970s. And every day in the cafeteria in Quito, all we talked about was who were the real communists, the Chinese or the Albanians, right? Every day in, you know, in Quito in 1978, 1979. So this mattered a tremendous amount to people around the world. And, you know, there are groups, you know, in the Iranian Revolution, there are left-wing groups who, by the late 1970s, follow Hoxha, right? Unbelievably. But, you know, this is a real thing.
I mean, we get it. We're particularly followers of Juche, but, you know, that's just us here. So, Jeremy.
I'm actually a Ceausescu person.
Oh, yeah. Derek and I can't stop fighting about it.
We do disagree about this.
I mean, this is all Monty Python, right? At some point, this is all Judean People's Front versus the People's Front of Judea, right? I mean,
particularly as time goes on, and it's just obvious that, you know, the vanguards are not actually trying to do communism in any meaningful way. But let's return to the early 60s. So the greatest man in history is elected president, John F. Kennedy. So how does that shape what's going on in the Sino-Soviet world? And maybe you could take us up to the Cuban Missile Crisis Checkpoint Charlie, and then we could end this episode there and we could pick up later on a future app.
Yeah, I mean, so I think what Kennedy does, you know, when they look at Kennedy, they see two things. Number one, they see someone who's young and inexperienced and therefore potentially weak and exploitable, right? This is not Eisenhower. This is not the grizzled old man who, you know, led the D-Day invasion. This is some kid who, you know, got elected president because his father bought his way to Harvard. And so, you know, they think they can take advantage of Kennedy, number one. And, you know, part of the Cuban Missile Crisis is a little bit of that too, right? The belief that, you know, who's this, you know, rich kid, whatever, who's in power in the United States. But the second thing about Kennedy, and this is really the major shift in policy from the American side they had to respond to, is that Kennedy sort of, in part, made his name in the Senate on talking about the developing world, right? Talking
the
about
decade
Algeria.
Of development. He comes in and announces the decade of development.
But Eisenhower was never terribly concerned with this. And Eisenhower didn't think the United States needed to support decolonization, right? And Kennedy does. Kennedy sees this is the future of the world. And if the United States is not going to be a player in, first of all, promoting decolonization, and second of all, promoting modernization after decolonization, then we're going to lose the developing world. And so this sort of, you know, shifts everything into hyperdrive, right? Before, you were just theoretically talking about it. You know, you could argue with the Ghanaians over, you know, little bits of aid. But if the United States is going to be in the game, you have to put your money where your mouth is. And so it shifts the kind of the aid game of the developing world into hyperdrive. And 61, 62, 63, right, those are really the high point of, you know, Soviet aid to the developing world.
Let's talk about that a bit. I think we've got some time. So what are the Soviets doing in the early 1960s? And what are the Chinese doing? How do they respond? What are the interactions?
So what the Soviets are doing is trying to follow the sort of, you know, state of national democracy, non-capitalist path. And that means, you know, you go to countries like, you know, Guinea, Ghana, Mali, Indonesia, India, and others, and you say, how can we help you industrialize? Maybe that means we build you a hydroelectric dam. Maybe that means we build you a metallurgical plant so you can make steel. Maybe that means you don't have steel yet. We'll send our geologists out to find, you know, whatever minerals you have and, you know, what we can use to exploit it and find out where the coal is and whatever. So there's Soviet geological teams going all around the developing world in the early 60s looking for the kinds of things that you can use to build heavy industry. And so that's what's happening. And, you know, a lot of you know, credits, which are supposed to be paid back with future production at a very low interest rate. The basic differences between Soviet aid, right, on financial terms between Soviet aid and the West is, first of all, lower interest rate. And second of all, the Soviets don't take equity. So, you know, we build the plant, we hand you the keys, we're not taking profits after. So this is why, you know, there are some people like to argue the Soviets are doing this for profit. They are not doing this for profit. This is not.
So you're saying, just to clarify, you're saying they're doing this for ideological reasons, or is there some other economic benefit in there?
There's really no economic benefit for the USSR. I mean, the Soviet Union is enormous. It has resources of almost everything. There's very little in the rest of the world. You know, they will look for oil in other places. They don't need oil. They have oil, right? You know, they look for diamonds elsewhere, but the Soviet Union has diamonds, right? This is not about domestic production. This is about the kind of industry that they will find, which will then help you build your own, you know, industrial base, working class, communist party, communist revolution, right? That's the plan. And the thing is,
with the idea, that post-communist revolution, you'll ally with the Soviet Union in its great struggle against international capitalism / the United States?
Well, yes, but even pre-communism, you'll do that. Like once you sign the aid agreement, they expect you to vote with them in the General Assembly.
You're got it, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. So they want to build communism, and this will build, you know, permanent alliances. But this is also, you know, as far as I'm concerned, this is the natural, inevitable path of history, right? This is the only way history can go, ultimately. They're just helping history along. For the Chinese, on the other hand, the Chinese, they don't have the money, right? They can't finance, you know, the plants and the dams and all the things the Soviets can do. They don't have as much engineering expertise. And they also think, first of all, they don't really believe this whole state of national democracy thing very much. Like, they think these countries are a long way away from socialism. You know, what they actually need, you know, the first thing they need is their people have to eat better, their people have to live better, their people have to wear nicer clothes. And that means, you know, a little bit of small-scale industry, even private property, you know, markets, land reform, right? The kinds of things that will, you know, increase people's living standards today and tomorrow, not in 20 years. So don't invest in, you know, steel plants, right? Invest in food processing plants. Invest in, you know, textile factories. Things will improve people's lives. And because by improving their lives, you build the legitimacy of your domestic political regime, so they're not tempted to go back and say, gee, things were better under the British. And you also maybe kick some of those British, you know, entrepreneurs and companies out of your country, right? Divest them. Like, as long as the foreigners own your economy, the foreigners will run your politics. It doesn't matter that you're nominally independent, right? So the Chinese are very concerned with, you know, kicking out foreigners in the economy. But the Chinese are also fundamentally concerned with, you know, sending arms to places that are still fighting, arms to Algeria, arms to Angola, arms to the Congo, right? And the Soviets are saying, we can't afford this because any one of these wars could turn to World War III and we don't want to go nuclear. So, you know, their visions of how you get socialism are different. Their visions of where these post-colonial countries are vis-a-vis socialism are different. And their visions of what matters in the world and what revolutionary tasks are different.
Just a couple of final questions. Is China the same thing? You develop the food processing plants and you send guns and they're your allies now?
Well, I mean, to a degree, but what does it mean to be Chinese ally? Like, I mean, there's some discussion about maybe you vote for China to be, you know, to replace, or the PRC to replace the ROC in the UN. I mean, there's a little bit of that, but in 1961, A, that's pretty far off. And B, the Chinese public line is, we don't even care about the UN, right? The UN is an imperialist organization. We wouldn't want to be a part of the UN. So, you know, I mean, at this point, being a Chinese ally, the most important element to being a Chinese ally in 1961, 62, and 63 is actually that you support them in internal debates against the Soviet Union. Right, that you vote with them in the Afro-Asian People's Solidarity Organization. By 64 and 65, the most important thing is that, you know, you vote not to invite the Soviet Union to the Second Bandung. That's much more important to them than anything about, you know, the United States.
So we're on the eve of the formal split here. So maybe we could just end with you letting us know, how does the Cuban Missile Crisis, how does Checkpoint Charlie, how does proto-détente shape things? Or is that not really shape things? Is that really a U.S.-Soviet story that doesn't really involve China and therefore not part of your story? Because from the Americanist perspective, this is the big moment, the Cuban Missile Crisis. That is, things change after that. So I'm just wondering from your perspective if that's correct or where you think it makes sense to end this episode.
Well, I mean, I think that does have an impact. It is important in the sense that, you know, the deeper détente gets, the more the Chinese are suspicious of Soviet intentions and the more they can sell the suspicion to the developing world. You know, the idea that, look, you know, there's still colonialism, right? You know, think about the countries that are still, you know, formerly colonies at this point. You know, Zambia is a colony, Angola is a colony, Kenya is not independent until 63, right? You have apartheid South Africa, a lot of things going on. Of course, there's problems with Israel, there's problems with, you know, Papua New Guinea. They're saying, look, you know, decolonization is incomplete. The West still dominates the world, and the Soviets want to make peace with the West, right? This clearly shows that you can't trust them. They can't lead the revolution because they care more about making peace with their white imperialist buddies in Europe and the United States than they do about, you know, global revolution. So the deeper data, and this is not just a rhetorical strategy, right? The Chinese are scared because if the Soviets make peace with the West, who's, you know, does that mean the Soviets have their back against the United States, right? I mean, no, there are American forces in Taiwan. There are American forces in South Korea, where a war is still officially going. You know, there are already, you know, small amounts of American forces in Vietnam, and soon there'll be a lot more. So the Americans are very active, you know, all around China, right? They're occupying part of what China considers its own territory. The Chinese are actually, they're involved in the Vietnam War too. So really, the U.S. and the Chinese are basically fighting. If the Soviets defect and say, you know, make what essentially would amount to a separate peace with the United States, then that means, you know, China's left to fight the United States all on its own. So, you know, their rhetoric about the Soviets betraying the revolution is not just, you know, it's not facetious. It's also about their own security concerns.
That's great. And we'll talk about the split in the next episode. Jeremy Friedman, thank you so much for joining us. Everyone check out his work. It's truly excellent. Jay, cut that out. Check out his work. It's truly excellent. And we look forward to having you back soon.
Thank you very much.